Okay. So, thank you very much to Sagirs for hosting again. I think it's become an annual or a biannual tradition of having Shiurim here in honor of Chagim. I think we've done Rosh Hashanah the last 2 or 3 years, and Pesach also maybe 1 or 2 years. Exactly. We should be zocha to continue helping Marvitz Torah and Yotzi Machnes Orchem to all the rest of us for good occasions and for learning. Okay, so I think I had conflicting things about what I was going to speak about tonight. I think on one thing I said I was going to talk about kashering countertops, and another one I think we wrote I was going to talk about halal. So maybe I'll do a combination, but I think we'll focus mostly on halal. The only reason I thought about kashering countertop is because 1 or 2 people had asked me about it during the week, so I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wasn't sure if I ever spoke about it before, but I think maybe we'll leave that for now. Most people in Yad Vashem basically kasher their countertops, and it's fine, but one person wasn't sure what they should do, so I was talking to them about it a little bit, and I think they told me that somebody said in America that they shouldn't kasher countertops that are similar to the ones that we have here, so that's why it became a whole discussion. I told them that the custom here in general is that we do kasher I think they're known as quartz. In Hebrew, they're just called shayish, but in English, I think they're called quartz or quartz resin countertops. So I was just telling them that in Israel, most people are makel and do allow kashering it, and it should be fine because it's mainly made out of stone. The reason why he was saying that some people said maybe not is because apparently a percentage of it is made out of plastic, and some poskim hold that you can't kasher plastic for Pesach. So if you hold that way, so then maybe you should say because a portion of the countertop is made out of plastic, you can't kosher it. I basically told them that the majority, as far as I understood, is made out of stone. So in general here, almost all the poskim are makel and allow it. And even in America, Gedaliah Schwartz from the CRC and the RC, they had it on the CRC website that he felt clearly that you're definitely allowed to kosher it. So that's the end of the story of countertops. I think in America, there's other kinds of countertops, but for here, that's good enough. Okay, so now we can go to our main topic here of halal. So when we think about halal, this is a good opportunity to talk about halal because we don't usually have an opportunity to talk about halal the rest of the year. I mean, we say halal a number of times during the year. We never really have a chance to talk about it or think about it. We learn the halachos based on it. So here what we'll do in the next couple of minutes is try to sort of take the back door into halal in general and learn a couple points about halal in general, and through that try to understand a little better about what the significance is of halal at the Seder. Let's do that by framing this in the following way. There are a number of halachos that have to do with halal in general, in terms of how halal is recited and what halal is recited for. And it seems like halal on the night of the Seder breaks every single rule. Strange. Hey, let's go through the rules. Anybody know what any of the rules about halal are, about when it's said or how it's said or why it's said? There's at least 4 or 5 different rules. I'm going to throw out some here that you might think of offhand.
Sing it in Na'i.
Okay, good. So we'll start with Naftali. Points out that in general, we don't say halal at night. Okay, that is the halacha, as mentioned in the Mishnah and Megillah. By the way, I'll just mention that a lot of these ideas I've had on my own as well, but it's put together very nicely in Rav Rimon's Haggadah. So I'm sort of using his format, his structure. If you're not familiar with his Haggadah, it's really excellent. It's nice Hebrew. It's also actually translated into English. There's 2 volumes. One is more of the Haggadah Divrei Torah, and one is more the Halacha section. This is the Halacha one. There's another one, which is the Haggadah part. The newer version is in purple, I think. This is the older version, which is in white. I actually got both. I got 1 white and 1 purple. Don't ask me why. But anyway, so he's got a nice little organization here on Halal, as he does with all the Halachas of the Seder and a lot of fantastic Divrei Torah. Some of my Shurim of Haggadah stuff that I gave last year and is based on his material. Really very, very highly recommended. So he points out here, and you know this is a famous Mishnah. Mishnah says that we say halal during the day. The entire day is appropriate for saying halal. And the Gemara says we learn it out from a pasuk in halal in the very first parak, Mizrach Shemesh Ad Mevo'om Hulal Shem Hashem. From the eastern rising of the sun, Ad Mevo'om, until it goes down, the name of Hashem is praised. So we see here that in halal itself, we talk about the sun going up and coming down. That's basically the daytime. And the Gemara says that's how we know that halal is recited during the daytime. Okay, that's great. And that's the psak in the Shulchan Aruch. So then what is going on the night of the Seder where we say halal at night? Okay, that's one problem. Okay, one breaking of the rule of halal at the Seder. Any else, other suggestions? What other rules for halal we usually have?
Who's
that? We only say it Mo'adim. So it's actually very similar to the point about at night. In general, we say Halal during the days of the holidays. Okay, we have Halal every day of Hanukkah. We have Halal on Shavuos. We have Halal on Sukkot. We have Halal on Pesach. We don't have Halal on Purim for a different reason. Rosh Chodesh, we say Halal. Halal Rosh Chodesh is actually only a custom. It's a minhag. It's not an actual obligation. Yeah, and you know that if you go to the Sephardi Shul or if you are Sephard, and you know that you don't say a bracha on Halal and Rosh Chodesh. Okay? I often see that. I often go to the Nates Minyan, and I'm the only one there who's saying, actually, that's not true. We actually have a few of us Ashkenazi rebels. We try to say a quietly so nobody gets mad at us. No, not usually. One time, Rav Elnikov actually wanted somebody to say a bracha for some reason, and he actually asked me to say it out loud. I was like, huh? Like, why are you saying that? That's like exactly the opposite of the rules of Minhag HaMakom. Okay, if you want, I'll do it. Anyway, so that's normally we say Halal on all these holidays, and it's during the daytime. This is unusual because we say Halal on Pesach in the day when you're supposed to say it. This is like an extra Halal at night. But then consider, why is it there? Okay, any other suggestions? Other rules of Halal? Okay, I'll throw them at you. All right, next one. So are women obligated to say Halal? Who's that?
Usually it's in Minyan.
Okay, so that doesn't have to be. Meaning, if you davened on your own, you would still say halal. You say it as part of tefillah. This halal is not part of tefillah. It's part of the seder. So that's the same part of the question. Why do we do it at night when it's not part of tefillah? Okay.
Well, why are you saying it a second time?
Okay, that's another good question. Well, I don't think we're going to have time to get into that if you want to have a shir tonight. So we'll leave that part out. I don't know if I gave a shir on this once. I don't know if Hadaya gave a shir on this once. If anybody's interested in some notes on the question of halal and shul, I have a whole page of notes about it. I'm happy to send it to you afterwards. There are a lot of different reasons why those that say halal and shul on Pesach night do so. Every one of them is unique, meaning there's a special reason why. And one of them might be related to why we say halal at night on the Seder. But what was it? It depends where. In Eretz Yisrael, generally people do. In Chutz La'aretz, most Ashkenazim do not. Nusach Sfarad, they do, but Nusach Ashkenaz generally does not, because the Ramah says you're not supposed to. Okay, go figure. But Eretz Yisrael, the Vilna Gaon, and many others say that you do, so we often have the minhag here because many people follow the Grah here, even for Ashkenazim. Anyway, so there's particular reasons why we might say it at Shul, the night of Pesach. The main reason, I'll just throw out one for you now, is basically that it may be symbolic of the fact that they said Halal. We'll get back to this in a minute also, when they offered their Korban Pesach in the afternoon of Yudal and Nisan, so that's the time that we sort of commemorate that by saying Halal, the same way they said Halal when they offered the Korban Pesach in the afternoon, and we say Halal to commemorate that at night during davening. Again, there's other reasons that also have some questions, but that's just one reason to throw out there. But the night of the Seder is different. Why do we say Halal the night of the Seder? In general, we have the obligation of women. Halal is a mitzvah shazman grama. Okay, it's a time-bound mitzvah. Women in general are exempt from time-bound mitzvahs. Okay, the night of the Seder, okay, the Rishonim say that Tosfos points it out in Sukkah and a number of other places, that women are supposed to halal the night of the Seder, the same way that they're supposed to say every other part of the Seder, or at least the main parts of the Seder, they're obligated. Why? Number three, what's your posture when you say halal normally? How is one supposed to say halal?
Standing.
Okay, that's the halacha. All right. The Shulchan Aruch says, and so Tzav Bet says, the way to say halal is mi'umar, is standing up. How do we say halal at the Seder? It's sitting, right? It's all of us. It's not just you. Don't think you're doing so weird because you say, oh, wait, I did something wrong. No, everybody says halal sitting down. Okay? That's a question. Why do we do that? It breaks the rules. Okay? Next question. All right? What else do we say before, except for Rosh Chodesh, what do we say before we start halal every other day?
Bracha.
We say a bracha. Do we say a bracha the night of the Seder on halal? Okay? It's a question, but what's the bottom line? Do we say a bracha or not? Do we say a bracha? Do we say a bracha al asher kiddushan v'sav tzivan al likro as ha'ala or more as ha'ala if you're Sephardi? Okay, the answer is no. And now you're right. Yeah. They talk, but why don't we say a bracha? Why don't we just say the normal bracha? What's wrong with us? Okay? Strange, right? And last, but definitely not least, okay, what do we do that's especially strange about ha'ala the night of the Seder as opposed to every other ha'ala we say on shul?
Right.
What's the halacha about ha'ala? This is a really important point that you should know. I don't know how many people actually know this. It should be known, but I don't know how well it is known, judging from looking around in shul sometimes, and you see a lot of activity during halal once in a while, which should not be taking place. It is usur to be mafsik to interrupt during halal in general. Get a halacha, especially when you make a bracha, meaning when you're supposed to say halal shalem, that you don't skip anything. And even on Rosh Chodesh, when you skip, same thing is true, but especially the real halacha is when you say the whole halal, You're not allowed to interrupt in the middle of challah. It's also to be mafsid. You cannot say things. You cannot talk to people. You can't repeat. Well, repeating the song is a question, whether you can repeat words. In general, that's also not supposed to be done, but that already is a discussion. But in general, you can't interrupt. Okay, this is a very important point for challah the rest of the year to keep in mind. When you say challah, you're not allowed to have an interruption in the middle. Okay, you have to say it. And if you're not sure if you missed a word, you got to say the word over again. You got to say the whole thing. Bracha from the beginning to the bracha at the end. Why in the world, on the night of the Seder, do we break it up with not only saying things and like saying the Haggadah, but we break it up with matzah and maror and a meal? Shulchan Aruch, a meal in the middle of challah, for goodness sakes. That's exactly the opposite of what the rule is of not being mafsik. It's like completely breaking the rule to the extreme, like breaking the rule to Lamahadrin, you know? What's going on here? What is this challah all about, the night of the Seder? Okay? That's the question. So you should just know, and Rabbi Mon points this out also, every one of those questions does have answers. Okay? But when you start thinking about the idea that there's so many questions, you sort of have to sort of believe that there's something that puts all those things together. I mean, there has to be, and there should be, one idea which really explains everything. Because it's too many coincidences and too many unusual factors of challah that each one would have to be answered on its own. It makes sense that there should be one idea. And let me share with you the idea, unless anybody wants to throw in your own suggestion, which might be the same as what I'm about to say. Any ideas? No. Okay, you're waiting. Bated breath. Okay. So here's the idea. Basically, and Ramon develops this at length, which we're not going to do now. But I'll just give you in the next 7 minutes, I'll give you the following thought. Okay. There's two types of howl. One type of halal, and this is the main type of halal that we say normally the rest of the year, is halal, which is, the halacha requires, and based on the Gemara, to remember something which happened in the past. Okay, it could be a holiday, meaning on the holiday of Shavuos, or the holiday of Sukkot. We say halal because a special day, a mo'ed, a festive day, okay, requires to say halal, to thank Hashem for giving us this special day and giving us whatever special, you know, kedusha we have on that day. We say thank you. Challah is all about thanks. Challah the Hodah. On Hanukkah, we're saying challah also because of something that happened. Okay? Here, this is the second type of challah, but we'll see that Pesach is a little bit different even in the second type. Challah on Hanukkah is really saying thank you to Hashem for a miracle that happened, not just because the day requires us to say challah, but rather because something special happened on that day, a miracle took place that we are celebrating. We're saying thank you, Hashem, for the miracle of Hanukkah. Okay, so that's different than, let's say, Sukkot or Shavuos, where the day, the chag, the festival nature of the day causes a sehal. On Hanukkah, yes, it's special, but it's because of a miracle. Okay, that's basically the two types of halal. Where does halal the night of the Seder fit? So halal the night of the Seder, as you may have guessed, is definitely closer to the second type. Okay, the first type is the halal we say during the day. Okay, the first type is halal we say standing up, which is halal because of the day, the mo'ed. The second kind of halal is also true, that it's during the day, it's also got to be standing up. But halal night of Pesach is closer to the second type because it's about a miracle, correct? And here's where we take a step further, okay? How is the miracle, again, not to be cliched here, how is the miracle the night of, you know, how is this night different than all other nights, or whatever, how is this halal different than all other halals? I think that's how I titled one of the things we sent out. How is this different? Okay, and the answer, as you may have guessed, you want to say it out? Look like you're about to answer the question. Sure.
Everyone is involved? I don't know.
Almost. You almost got it.
To get the fishings? Get the well fishings?
That may be true, but that's not how it's probably not part of that.
I mean, it's sort of like you're supposed to be feel like you're experiencing.
There we go. That's it. That's what you're probably going to say also, right? Okay, that's what I figured. Very good. So that's basically what a number of the Mefarshim spell out when it comes to this point. And each one is in different ways. I'm not going to go through all the proofs here, but just give you the basic idea. I guess you would call it the third type of halal, or the type of halal which is like 2B, is the type of halal where you're not just saying halal for a miracle that took place in the past. It's a type of halal called shira. Okay, what is shira other than, you know, some people's daughters' names here or wife's names? Shira is song, and this in the Gemara. There's a number of times in the Gemara where the Gemara talks about halal and uses the word shira. Just give you one example again. There's a lot of ideas about this, which I'm not going to get into now. Just one example. You get the point. It says that when Chizkiah, remember Chizkiah HaMelech, so he had a tremendous miracle that took place during his time when the kingdom of Ashur came and surrounded Yerushalayim, and they were going to come and destroy everything, break it up, take it over. And overnight, okay, by the way, I mean, know when this took place? The night of Pesach. Okay, the night of Pesach. So the Rishali actually links these two things together. And without getting too detailed, though, what happened that time? Everybody got killed. 185,000 Ashurim, Assyrians, got wiped out overnight in a miraculous plague. And the Gemara basically says Chizkiyahu was supposed to say Shira, and he didn't. And that's part of the problem. Why didn't he say it? And we're not going to go into that now. But the term the Gemara uses is Shira. What does Shira mean? Shira means song. And in this context, essentially what's happening in this and other sources is that the night of Pesach, the Hal we say, is Midin Shira. It's a type of song rather than just the standard obligation of Chazal to say Hal. How is the song of Hal different than the regular obligation of saying Hal? And the answer is, again, as you may have already figured out, is that Shira is something that you say when it happens to you. It's something that you say when you witness something, a miraculous event at that time. So the time of Chizkiyahu and other events, we say Hal is Shira because they saw it and they said, oh my gosh, this amazing thing happened. I have to say Hal Takanash Baruch Hu. I have to say it. Why? Because God told me to? No, not because of the Shulchan Aruch says so. Because I feel it. It's inside of me. It's emotionally coming out. And the night of the Seder, essentially what the Mefarshim say, is the same idea. That what we're supposed to be feeling, again, this is another expansion of the famous idea that a person has to see himself as leaving Mitzrayim, but this is sort of, you have to take it a little more emotionally here. Okay? It's not just, oh, I left Mitzrayim and I'm walking out with a matzah on my back. You have to really feel it in a sense that you're so emotional about it and so enthusiastic about it that you want to say Shira on your own without the Haggadah telling you you have to do so. Okay? Meaning you're supposed to feel it, wow, this happened to me. Hashem took me out of Mitzrayim, and this is such an amazing event that took place in my life. If you can really feel that, if you can get to the point that you really experience it, then it becomes Shira. It's not just Hal, it's song. It's an automatic song. It's a natural song. It just comes from you. It comes from your mouth, and you should be saying Hal. This is the post can say this also, by the way. You should say Hal the same way as you say the Haggadah with such emotion that it's something that you're not like falling asleep at the table at 1 o'clock in the morning, which happens to some people, unfortunately. You got to basically try to keep yourself awake and in such a state of ecstasy and simcha and joy that it's just bubbling out of you. It's just there. And it's just, you know, and I think that the singing you should sing at Hallel, the night of the Seder, should be even one step beyond the singing that we sing sometimes in Shul when we say Hallel. Because Shira, again, Shira means song, but it's a song, you know, a special, a natural song, a song which just comes out from in you. Because of that, that really explains all the points, meaning that's why we are saying Hallel at night and not during the daytime, because at night, if something happens to you, if a miracle happens to you exactly at night at that time, then you're going to say Hallel because that's what you're celebrating. The same thing with the night of the Seder, because we are believing that we went through the Seder, we went through the Yetzias Mitzrayim, so the Hallel is natural. That's the time that we're going to say Hallel. Then we have the other points of women. So of course, women, afen hayu bosu anis, women that experience a miracle have to say halal as well. It's not just time-bound mitzvah. It's halal because that's what's happening. The miracle is taking place at that point. Halal sitting down. So here also, halal sitting down is because it's part of this, where Rimon develops very nicely. It's not just the regular halal. It's halal as part of the telling of the story. Halal is a part of the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, the night of the Seder. This is part and parcel of our telling of the story. It's not just saying what happened, but thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not just by saying thank you Hashem, like we do in the Haggadah a few times, but saying Shira, saying the song of feeling the emotion of taking us out with saying, you know, Hodu Hashem Kitov Kidu Lev Chasdu, and every step along the way of Hallel. That's what Hallel is all about, is part of the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. And the same way we say Sipur is sitting down as, you know, as relaxed, Derech Cherus, as in a way of a manner of freedom, the same thing is true about Hallel as well.
What about breaking it up?
Oh, we'll get to that. That's the last point. I'm going to conclude with that. Just before we get to that, in terms of the bracha, so again, there are a lot of answers about what we do with the bracha on the night of Hallel of the Seder. Some say that at the beginning of the Haggadah, maybe there's a bracha that's hidden in the Haggadah somewhere, included in some other part of the Haggadah, at the end of Magid. It could be that those somehow take the place of the bracha on the Hallel. But what Ramon suggests, and this is based on another one, he quotes here, but basically, it's based on the Yerushalmi also, actually, and the Medrash, that that the night of Pesach, Hallel as a Shira doesn't need a bracha, because we're not doing it because God commanded us to say Hallel. We're doing it because we want to say Hallel. We want to show Hashem that we believe and we understand. We feel it. And if we feel it, then it just comes out. It comes out naturally. Last point. Okay, this is really an amazing idea. Why do we break it up? What's the point of breaking it up in the middle of in the Seder, half before our Shulchan Aruch and our Matzah Amarah and half afterwards? So here again, you could have a few different suggestions here, but I'll just tell you the way Rabbi Mon sort of develops this in brief. Basically, number one, on one hand, Hallel before the Suda, this other thing is already in Barbanel and a few other Mefarshim, Hallel before the Suda is representative of Hallel in Egypt. Hal after the Suda is representative of the miracles L'Atid Lavo, okay, the miracles in the future, which we already sort of feel that we're starting to experience. So we want to sort of connect them together the same way that we had Hal, we experienced the miracles of the Seder. So too, we want to experience the miracles in the future and already direct our praise to them as if they already happened. That's one dimension. The other dimension, and this is based a little bit more on the Maharal, I think you were correctly. This is based a little more on the Maharal, is that the meal is supposed to be sandwiched in, no pun intended, sandwiched in by the challah. The challah before the meal and the challah after the meal basically turn the meal and the matzah into an expression of thanks as well. Meaning that we want to show that the challah is connected to the matzah, which is also representative of the Korban Pesach, which is the korban that we offer on Pesach to thank Hashem and to celebrate what Hashem, the fact that Hashem took us out. But in addition, the meal itself is what we call a sudat hodaya. It's a meal of thanksgiving, meaning that the meal itself is supposed to be not just a regular meal that we have. There's a mitzvah of having a meal on every Yom Tov and every Shabbos, but the meal of the Seder is a special sudat hodaya, sort of like we say anytime that we have a real miracle that took place in our time, which again, without getting too much into this now, Yom Ha'atzmaut, this is actually very much connected to that idea. So here also, Sudat Hoda'a, the night of the Seder also, that should be the kind of meal that we have. Which means, again, it's not just having a meal because we have a mitzvah, it's because we feel that we're experiencing the miracle, and we want to show Hashem, thank you Hashem, for making a meal. So because we conclude now, we put all these points together. So we basically, what we're trying to get out of the halal here, is that the halal of the Shira is sort of an extra special level of halal, of experiencing the night of Mitzrayim, of going through Mitzrayim and coming out, feeling that we really went through it and feeling the emotion, not just saying we went through it intellectually, but also the emotional part of feeling that we went through it and feeling the joy of going through it and thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a natural way, not just because the Haggadah says to thank it, because we really feel it, which takes work. Okay, this is what Hachana before Pesach is about, to get yourself up to the point that you really feel that this can be done and that you understand what happened and you can feel it in your emotions. Mezar Hashem, basically, the idea should be that when we get to challah, both before the meal and after the meal, and the meal itself, we should basically have these ideas of thanking Kadosh Baruch Hu for everything that happens. We should be able to stay awake during the challah and to really sing the challah as a shira in the way that that it should be recited for really being able to appreciate the amazing goodness and kindness that Kadosh Baruch Hu has given us both back in those days as well as in our times.
Do we say that Bnei Yisrael sang Hallel when I left?
Say that again?
Do we say that Bnei Yisrael sang Hallel when I left the Mitzrayim?
They definitely may have said Hallel when they ate their Korban Pesach.
No, but when they left.
So that's not clear. Do you know what they said? They actually said Hallel when they actually left?
The women definitely.
That's when they crossed the Red Sea, right? Yeah. So the Mishnah in Misachim and Daf Tzadi Hey, I think, mentions that they did say Hallel when they ate their Korban Pesach, which was at night, but I think when they actually started walking out, I don't think it says that they said Hallel at that point. Again, that's another part of the discussion which I didn't have time for, which is basically that we already, even though they started leaving in the day, the next morning, we already sort of bumped that up to the nighttime because the process of the Gula already began. Once it already began with the putting the blood on the doorpost and going into the house and whatever, that's already the process. We celebrate at the beginning of the process what's going to happen afterwards because we know what's going to be.
Grizz has a whole piece on this. The Shira is something that's spontaneous.
Right, yeah, sounds familiar. Is he talking about Pesach or something else?
And he's talking, he connects it to Pesach and Hanukkah, or not Hanukkah, but Pesach.
Right.
But yeah, that's why you say the first
right away, because at that point you say, oh, I don't know what these things are. the topic I gave, the title I gave, is the chosen people because they chose. And it was based on a question which I'm following this on the sheet. It's going straight through the street sheet. Rav Nosson Weiss, who teaches in Eshet Torah, happens to be where I used to live. He lived across the street from me. He asked a question that we see in Makat Pekorot that the Bnei Israel needed a protection. In all the first nine Makot, the Makot affected only the Egyptians, and Bnei Israel didn't need any protection. Whereas in the 10th plague, Makat Bechorot, B'nai Israel needed protection. The question is, why? What was different about the 10th plague than the first 9? And that's what we're going to be talking about. So I first want to show you that B'nai Israel needed a protection in the 10th plague. So if you look on the first source, in Shemot, and so Hashem, this is telling B'nai Israel, Hashem is telling Moshe to tell B'nai Israel, V'avati be'eretz Mitzrayim, b'layla hazeh, v'kiti kol b'chol be'eretz Mitzrayim, me'donava behemo, v'chol Elohei Mitzrayim, eshesh v'atim ani Hashem, v'ya adam lechem la'ot al abatim asher atem sam, sham, v'ra'iti et adam ufasachti alechem, v'lo yeh b'chem negif la'ashmachshit, v'akoti be'eretz Mitzrayim. B'nai Israel have to put the blood on the door in order for them to be protected. Otherwise, it seems, at least, you know, simple reading of the Pasuk, that the Negev, the plague, will also affect them. Okay? And then, later on, in Midbar, Kili kol b'chor b'yom hakoti kol b'chor b'eretz Mitzrayim, hikdash li kol b'chor b'Yisrael, mi'adam ad behemo, li yu ani Hashem. I gained the right of the b'chor b'nei Israel because I struck the b'chor of Mitzrayim, but I didn't of b'nei Israel. So we see that B'nai Israel needed protection from Makat Bechorot. The other Makot, we don't. They didn't need a protection. Just to bore two examples. One is the famous Medrash about the water, that when the water turned to blood, that if an Egyptian was drinking from the cup, it was blood. If the Jew drank from the cup, it was water. It was automatic. The Jew didn't have to do anything. It was automatic. Also, it says specifically in the Pasuk, when in Makat Dever, V'hifleiti b'yom ahu et eretz Goshen, asher ami omeil aleha, l'vilti ayot sham arov, sikha the arov, l'man teda ki ani Hashem b'ker of ha'aretz, v'samti v'dut b'en ami u'vein amecha l'macha yehot hazeh. When it came to the arov, I made a mistake and said Dever, but the arov, that it was clear, my B'nai Israel are different. B'nai Israel didn't have to do anything. We didn't have to put blood on doors or anything like that. So we see that there's a difference between Makat Bechorot and the other 9 plagues. So the question is, why? What's the difference in Makat Bechorot? In order to answer that question, I have to decide, what is a Bechor? What is the significance of a Bechor? And that I'm relying on Rav David Foreman, who discusses the idea. Other people discuss it, but I heard it from him first. And that is that the Bechor represents the parents to the next generation. He's supposed to be the transition or the connection between the parents and the next generation, right? So therefore, when we talk about a Bechor of Mitzrayim, their Bechor is their, in a certain sense, the continuation of their legacy, of their heritage. Whatever Mitzrayim represented, what their culture was, their Bechor is going to pass it on to the next generation. On the other hand, you have in B'nai Israel, remember that all of B'nai Israel are Hashem's Bechor. That's the Pasuk I bring from Shmot. V'amarta el Paro, Hashem is speaking to Moshe. This is the very beginning, before the plagues began. V'amarta el Paro, ko amar Hashem, b'ni Bechori Yisrael. Who is my Bechor, is Hashem's Bechor? B'nai Israel. You don't let my Bechor go, I'll get rid of your Bechor. Okay? So what does it mean that we're Bechor? If the Bechor represents the culture of the parent, and we are the Bechor, B'nai Israel are the Bechor of Hashem, it means that we represent the culture of Hashem. Whatever Hashem wants people to understand, this is the way you should behave in the world, B'nai Israel are supposed to represent that. This nation is supposed to be able to look at us and say, this is the way a person should act. This is the way a person should believe. This is the way a person should present himself. Okay. So B'nai Israel are the Bechor of Hashem. The Bechor of Mitzrayim are their Bechorot. What does it mean to be a Bechor of Hashem? That we see from Abraham. This goes back to Avraham. That's the next question. How do we represent Hashem? Ki yidativ leman asher yitzaveh et banav et beito acharav Rishamru derech Hashem lasot tzedakah u'mishpat l'man havi Hashem al Avraham et asher diber elav. What is the quintessence of Avraham that he was chosen by Hashem? Because it never really says why Hashem chose Avraham. In the beginning of Lech Lecha, it just says, Avraham, go. And it doesn't tell us why. It only comes out really when it comes with the story of Sodom, etc., etc., at this point. What is it? Because Avraham is going to teach his children what Hashem represents. And what is that? Tzedakah u'mishpat. That's the essence of... I feel like I'm in shul. excuse me. We already see with Avraham that when we, B'nai Yisrael, Hashem's before, that this, we're supposed to represent this idea of tzedek mishpat, and we'll discuss a little bit more about that in a moment, where it comes from Hashem. Okay? So what is it? What was the death of the firstborn of the Egyptians? Right. Well, they were given 9 chances to learn a lesson. All the 9 plagues were to teach them, look, you let my people go, you let my people, actually Hashem even didn't ask to let them go, let them go and serve me, etc., etc. I'm not getting into the whole discussion what it was that they're really asking for. He said, Hashem says, you learn the lesson? Fine. He gave them 9 chances, and somehow they didn't learn the lesson. He said, now, we got to end it. Killing the Bechor of Mitzrayim was saying, I am destroying the Egyptian culture. Whatever Egypt represents, which is represented by your Bechor, I'm destroying it. It has to be ended. Okay. And Rav Hirsch talks about what was so terrible about the Egyptian culture. He says that he takes all the 9 plagues, and he puts them into 3 categories. Some are to show the Egyptians that Geirut, you don't treat Geirim improperly. The others are teach about you don't enslave people. And the other one, you don't afflict people. Right? And he goes into it's very interesting to read Vavirsh, right? He talks about the first of each set of plagues, you have the Tzach HaDash V'Chav. The first of each plague was that the Egyptians couldn't recognize their land. There was a total change with the weather changes, the blood, the water becomes blood, etc. The second one is they lose control, that you have now the animals coming, all the different things that happen. And finally, there was a bodily suffering to the body directly on them, which parallels the idea of being a ger, of being an eved, and of being somebody who's mu'neh, somebody who is being afflicted. Okay? They didn't learn the lesson. Hashem says, I have to destroy it. Okay? But he's going to replace them, this idea, with his Bechor, with B'nai Yisrael. Now, there's one problem when you have a revolution. What very often happens, and there are few exceptions, American Revolution might be one of the few exceptions, but generally what happens, or very often what happens, is you get the change in the players, but the same problems that existed before.
The same game,
right? Except now, who was on top is now on bottom, the person on bottom is now on top, right? So I remember, probably something you're all too young to remember, but there was a Hutus in Tutsis, right? Right there, and they killed each other. You know, well, there was a mass murder, but what they didn't realize is that that's been going on for years. Right? They would murder one, and then they would become powerful. The other one would become powerful. They would murder, right? One time somebody, in the time of the first Lebanon War, one Israeli general gave a description, he said, about all the different fightings was going on within Lebanon, the Christians, the different types of Muslims, etc., right? And then he said, oh, yeah, that's really what's going on. He said, I'm reading a report from 100 years ago, right? Things don't change. And that's one of the problems, right? So Hashem is saying to B'nai Israel, you're going to be my Bechor. You're not going to just replace the Egyptians with their philosophy and their approach. You're going to have to become with a new approach. You're going to have to be those who represent Tzedek u'Mishpat, because you're going to represent me. And so B'nai Yisrael, after this point, make a decision. Are they going to be with Hashem, or are they going to be with the Egyptians? Are they going to be the same as the Egyptians? And we know, you mentioned that, I'm sorry, I came late, I was in the class, right? That 4/5 of the people were killed. 4/5 of the people were Egyptians. And what I mean by the Egyptians, the Jews who thought like Egyptians. I said, I don't want you. You can't represent me. It's only 1/5 who could represent, with all the problems of them. But something about them, they could represent. Hashem said, but B'nai Israel had to do one thing. They had to show where they stand. And that was the proper purpose of, one of the purposes, I shouldn't say the only purpose, but one of the purposes of the Paschal Lamb, of the Korban Pesach. You have to make a decision where you stand. And that's why I'd like to just talk a little bit about some of the things that we have with the Pesach sacrifice that show this. That a person has to say, I'm attaching myself to the Jewish mission, and therefore Hashem can take me out of Mitzrayim because I can represent him, or I'm not attaching myself to the Jewish mission, in which case Hashem says, I don't want you because you're only going to be baggage for me. You're not going to be able to do that, right? First of all, there's a certain recognition that Hashem controls the world, right? If by you know the Midrash, you know about, they took the 4 days, we can talk a little bit slightly differently. They counted, they took the Seah 4 days earlier, they took their animal 4 days earlier, so the Egyptians would come in and say, what's this? Well, we're going to sacrifice it, right? The Jews had to be able to say, we no longer fear our masters. They had to be able to say, we trust in God. If God says, this is what's going to be, and you're going to be safe, Leil Shavuim, etc., etc. In fact, that's one of the reasons they give for the Shabbat HaGadol, because the Shabbat HaGadol was when they took the sacrifices, that was the 4 days before, and the Egyptians came in and said, what are you doing? And you would expect a mass slaughter of Jews. Nothing happened. That was the first statement of the Jews. We trust in God. Once God controls the world, once you believe God controls the world, number one, you can do whatever Hashem says. And number two, Hashem can bring about a change. That's on the individual level and the national level. An individual can change, and that's always possible. This is going to, you're going over to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the possibility of tshuva, etc., etc. That believing in God means that that's possible. Remember, the Egyptian society was an extremely stringent caste society. Mitzrayim is narrowness, right? You couldn't change. You were born in this caste, that's the caste you were in. And there's no such thing as change. They had no concept of change. Or what a person. And Judaism says, it's not like that at all. Anybody can change. And this 70-year-old man can come and say, I want to change. There's never a time when a person can't change. That's the first part, right? By accepting that you're part of this mission. But then within the sacrifice itself, we can see certain things. First of all, and I'm looking on the very last section, lessons from the sacrifice. Must be counted on the sacrifice. A person had to be part, you couldn't come in and say, I decided I want to be part of this, I want to eat this Korban Pesach, right? You had to be counted before the Shita as one of the people that was going to be eating. Otherwise, you couldn't eat. What does that mean? Well, let me ask you, sort of keep you awake a little bit, right?
It means that you have to come, that you can't just see that now they've killed the lambs or whatever, and now he's having them, so I can't join, I'm not scared of anything. You're coming before, you're showing, I believe in God, I'm not scared of what could happen, I believe in God, and go through the whole process.
Okay, I'm going to take what you said, I think exactly what you were saying, exactly what I wanted, and one word, commitment. Okay? You have to make a commitment. That's one thing. Right? We take it 4 days before. Okay, the standard answer is given is that, because we just said that the Egyptians should see it, etc., etc. There's a Medrash which connects it to the Akedah, that they took it, I don't know how quite they work it out, because it's 4 days and 3 days, but it relates the idea that Avram went for 3 days with the Akedah, and then, and B'nai Israel have 3 days, and then on the fourth day they sacrifice it. They sacrifice, because actually they've sacrificed the Korban on Yud Dalet, They took a yud, so that's yud, yud alf, yud bet, yud gimel. If, whatever it is, the medrash somehow works it out, the connection, right? So I'm accepting the medrash. Okay? So again, why Abraham? Why connect it to the Akidah? What is it about the Akidah? Number one is, again, the commitment. Hashem says, I do. It'll be okay. Whatever God says, that's the way it's supposed to be. Right? But there's also, again, Abraham was the one who was going to teach his children. This very person he's about to kill, this is the one he's going to teach Tzedek U'Mishpat. Somehow, this has to be part of the Korban Pesach too. You have to see your relationship with Abraham. Okay? The Korban Pesach was for a household. Right? There's emphasis on bayit, right? There's always bayit. Right? Why? Why the household? What is a household, not the house, household. What does a household include?
Avdim.
Servants. Servants? They probably didn't have servants. But I want to come back to that too, because that is very, very, right?
Usually a parent's parents is a commitment.
Okay, you have parents. When did you use it to parents? The children. Right? The house, that's this idea that you have to pass it on to the next generation, right? It's commitment too. Right, because parents are committed to, I hope so, right? parents are committed to children, right? But heard a speech about that. That's the one, Rabbi Ghazi, if anybody was there, that's the one connection that's never broken, etc., etc. It's totally unconditional. Anyway, but the emphasis again on it's not just one generation; it's going to be all the generations. We're passing on a legacy. That it's going to be for all times, and therefore it's a household. And you mentioned about the Avadim. They probably didn't have Avadim at that time. They were Avadim. So they didn't have Avadim. But interestingly enough, a few weeks later, when we see the Torah in Parshat Mishpatim, there's all about Avadim. So some explain, why is it there? Because Bnei Israel had just come out of Mitzrayim and knew what it was to be an Eved, and therefore they would not mistreat their Avadim in the future when they would have Avadim. When you experience it now, remember it now, so when you'll later, you'll remember it better. And that's also how many of the mitzvot that we have, ki Avadim ha'yitim b'mitzrayim, ki gerim ha'yitim b'mitzrayim, Jews took their experience instead of saying, now we're going to be masters and we're going to do to other people what was done to us, Bnei Israel said no. We're going to learn and we're going to remember how to treat the Ger, how to treat the Eved, how to treat this person who's different, how to treat the person who somehow is not the strongest person in society. Okay? Blood on the doorpost is very interesting. But one of the explanations, it goes all, you know, it was on the side. It was on the inside, mind you, not on the outside. Right? God doesn't need to see it. It was for Bnei Israel to see. Okay? But one explanation I heard, it's the Mizbeach. Right, we put the dam on the Mizbeach. Now the entire house is becoming a Mizbeach. Because what do we do? What's the purpose of a Mizbeach? The purpose maybe is to bring us closer to Hashem. Right? Your entire household, what you do in your house is more important than what you do outside your house as far as bringing how you treat your children, how you treat your wife. That's the criterion. Many people are perfect outside, right? When people see, but in their homes it's something else. In your home, that's the way. This is the Mizbeach, okay? Interestingly enough, this karet for not bringing a Korban Pesach, this is in their time, and also for all times. Why? What does karet mean?
It means you're excluded from Israel.
You're excluded. You're excluded from the group in some form. In Olam Habah, whatever you're excluded from. Why is somebody who doesn't bring a Korban Pesach, why is he karet? Why is he saying?
He's not making a commitment.
Right. Because he didn't make a commitment. Okay? There are only two mitzvot to say that you have karet for. One is the Korban Pesach. What's the other one? Brit Milah. What is Brit Milah?
It's joining Israel.
It's joining Israel. It's a commitment, but it's also control. The idea, I can control. It's Avram. It's again, this idea, we can be different. We can control. We can change. You know, you can't say, well, that's the way I am. You know, I don't know if it's still popular. When I was a teenager and 20 years old, well, you take me the way I am. You know, which meant I don't have to change. You know, I have to be. No, Judaism says, on the contrary, you have to change. And that's what we represent. They have the ability to change, and the need to change, of course, in a specific fashion. And that's why Mila is a prerequisite to the Korban Pesach. A person who did not have milah, even if had later on when they did have slaves, if his slave didn't have milah at all, he wasn't allowed to eat the Korban Pesach, because you have to make that double commitment. You have to make the commitment from yourself, but you have to say, I'm not only part of Eretz B'nai Israel, I'm the ideal of B'nai Israel, of the ideal of control, the idea of representing Hashem. So B'nai Israel had to, at that moment in Mitzrayim, they had to say where they belong. Do they belong with the Egyptians, or do they belong with Hashem? And that's why I said we were the chosen people, because we chose. Because our ancestors, Baruch Hashem, made the wise decision of bringing the Korban Pesach and all that entailed. And there's Baruch Hashem, that's why we're here today. There's Hashem, maybe, hopefully, in a few days we'll also be in the Korban Pesach.